that the Lord uses us in very unique ways outside our normal environment. I shared with the people at Grace Community Church that we were on this cruise a couple of weeks ago. Friday night, a man had a heart attack. In fact, three people had heart attacks. In fact, six people had heart attacks on this particular cruise during the week. We dropped one off in Ketchikan, dropped another one off in Sitka, dropped another one off in Juneau. Then on the final night, three all at once had heart attacks. And somebody came to the dinner table and got me to go down into the hold of the ship. And here was one of the men who was with our group on the cruise and been a part of our Bible studies and all that. And they thought he was dead. He was green and he was having his massive heart infarction, they call it. And he was dying. So his wife was there holding his hand and praying, and she asked me to come in and pray. And when I first went in, the nurse said, "I'm sorry, you can't come in here. We're very busy. And three people have got a heart attack in the hold of this ship." And the doctor said to me, "That's enough to put a big ER room in a major hospital in total chaos, to say nothing of this little place. They didn't have equipment to monitor all these people." And the nurse said, "You'll have to. You can't be here." And then three or four other people started coming down, you know, who cared. And then there were about five or six or seven or eight people down there. They were getting very nervous, and I went in and tried to stand on one side of the bed and, "Please move over. Could you move over here?" And, you know, it was just obviously in the way. And as the night went on, and we began to continually pray, Jim Rickard was there, and Mel Hankinson was there, and we were praying for this guy to live, and the Lord wonderfully spared his life. And the doctor began to kind of watch this. And finally the doctor walked over to us, and he pointed at all our stomachs. "This guy's a tough doctor, you gotta know. He's about 60, he's got about a 30-inch waist, and he weighs 216, he told me. He's unbelievable condition. And he teaches paramedics how to rescue people with scuba equipment underwater paramedics. He teaches parachute paramedics, teaches people how to parachute out of airplanes for sea rescue. And when he's not doing that and doctoring in a ship, he flies in a DC-3 with skis across the top of Canada in the Yukon Territory and the Northwest Territory as a medevac to go into tribes of Indians in primitive areas to doctor them. I mean, this is the last of the frontier doctors. This guy's unbelievable. You know, tough as nails. All his life in emergency situations. And he's got three heart attacks going at the same time." And he walked over to me after an hour and he put his arm around him and he says, "I got to tell you something. You might not understand this, but this is fun. This is fun." I mean, he was in his glory. I mean, so a little later in the night, he starts pointing at our stomachs. I don't know if you were there, Jim, when he did. And he says, "You guys got to take care of those. You got to deal with that." He says, "That raises your heart attack risk 40%. He says, "I'm concerned about you. You got to take care of that." We're all standing there looking like this, you know. So about an hour later, I walked up to him and I put my arm around him. We'd gotten to be pretty good friends. We'd been together about 10 hours in the hold of the ship with these people. We'd been praying all night, and he'd been doctoring all night, and all three of them were alive. He had me praying for the other people too, because he saw it working with the guy that was with us. So I was going down the row, you know. So we got to be pretty good friends. So he came over to me, and I put my arm on his shoulder, and I said, "Doc, I said, you know how concerned you are about our physical condition?" He said, "That's right." I said, "That's how concerned I am about your spiritual condition." He goes, "Fair enough, fair enough." He says, "Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that." So we sat down and we talked. And he told me the whole story of being raised in a Catholic church, going to the priest, which he thought was the right thing to do, to ask an honest question, getting totally turned off, bolting the Catholic Church. For 9 years, he said, "I was a Baptist. At the end of 9 years, the pastor ran off with a bunch of women and found out he'd been involved with a bunch of other women. I chucked the whole thing." He said, "I haven't been in a church since 1969. And I said, "I don't want to talk about church. I want to talk about God. I want to talk about Christ. That's the issue." And he said, hey, "I'm in process. I'm in process. I haven't given up. I'm in process." "Well, how's the process going?" "Well, I'm open. I'm open." So he is the happy recipient of a box of tapes by this time. And you can be praying. His name is Will, W-I-L-L. He's somewhere in the Panama Canal this week, doctoring people. He goes out. I don't know what he does. I don't know how he works his schedule, but he's all over the world. Pray for Will. But you know, you get the most amazing opportunities to witness that you never would expect. And the Lord opens those opportunities for you, whether it's in your neighborhood or in a very unexpected place. And what made it especially good was everybody was getting well. You know, so God was doing very well in his mind. You know, God was coming through and he was having to deal with that. So it was an interesting evening. I want to share with you this morning a favorite portion of scripture of mine that I have grown to love through the years. Open your Bible to Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah chapter 5. I want to help to give you at least some perspective with regard to this time of missions emphasis. And I think that Isaiah 5 and 6 will give you a general insight and then a specific application that might be of help to you. We're all very familiar with the fact that Isaiah was a unique prophet. He had a great impact on the people of God. He spoke to the people of Jerusalem and of Judah. He spoke about the fact that they were apostatizing from the truth. They were drifting away from God. His ministry was a warning ministry in many ways to them. In fact, you see right here at the outset in chapter 5 of this prophecy that he is already telling them that judgment is inevitable. Now what you have here in Isaiah 5 is a message to a nation about to be judged. It was still a little ways away, but it was already inevitable. In other words, they had turned from God, they had turned from obedience, they had turned from a proper heart of worship, and the prophet Isaiah is here predicting the devastation that is going to come upon the nation Israel. It came in the form of the Babylonian captivity. He is predicting that that is going to come. This is a message of judgment on a nation that has departed from God. I say that simply to let you know that that is a good parallel to the time in which we live. I believe we live in a nation that has departed from God. Would you agree with that? We are moving fast away from the heritage that once was ours. And the message that I see in Isaiah 5 and also 6 is a message that is extremely relevant to the culture in which we live and to those of us who are called by God to try to reach this culture as Isaiah was called to reach the culture that God placed him into. Look at chapter 5, verse 1. It starts out with a parable. In fact, this is a song. You'll notice verse 1 says, "Let me sing now for my well-beloved a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard." Now here is a song. What kind of song? It's a dirge. You know what a dirge is? It's a funeral song. It's a sad song. It's a melancholy song. It's a woeful song. And it's a song about a vineyard. Now this is a very simple song, and yet it has tremendously profound implications as to its meaning. Here's the song. "My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill, and he dug it all around, removed its stones, and planted it with the choicest vine. And he built a tower in the middle of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. Then he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only bu'oshim," the Hebrew says, "sour berries, worthless ones." Very simple song. It was very understandable in that culture because people were into vineyards. In fact, they used to say that Palestine was one great agricultural piece of ground, and it was divided into two parts. It was divided into the valleys and the mountains. In the valleys was grain, and on the mountains was grapes. They would terrace the hillsides. If you go to Israel today, the hillsides are terraced, and vineyards are on the hillsides. The great plains and valleys are filled with grain. Everybody knew about growing grapes. That was a way of life in an agrarian society. And what the song emphasizes is the fact that this man had a vineyard in a very fertile place. In other words, he found the best place and he put his vineyard there. He dug it all around. What is that? Well, they used to put a moat or a hedge around a vineyard to protect it from animals. To protect it from animals that would come and eat the grapes. They might put a moat, put water in it. They might put a large hedge that small animals or even large animals couldn't get through. They had to protect the vineyard. Removing its stones was important. If you didn't remove the stones out of the soil, then obviously the thing wouldn't grow because the roots would be hitting the stone all the time. If you go to Palestine today, as you look at the terraced hillsides, you will see that they're terraced with stone. And the stone comes right out of the ground. They make the walls out of the stone they remove from the soil. So it's a tremendous amount of effort to do this. Then it says, he planted it with the choicest vine. He found the finest plant that he could possibly find and put it in the best soil on the best hill with the best protection and the best preparation. Then he built a tower in the middle of it. That's a high tower. He did two things with it. One, they used it to store their equipment. And two, they used it as an observation point to see if somebody was invading it. Because obviously it was a precious thing and people could come in and steal their grapes or animals could find their way through the hedges or the moats. And so there was a tower that acted as a point of protection. And usually associated with the tower was, sometimes even inside the tower, was a wine press where they could press out the grapes and make it into juice. That's why it says, and hewed out a wine vat in it, a place for the pressing of the grapes. Now, that's a lot of effort, a tremendous amount of investment of time and money and energy, and he expected it to produce good grapes. But it produced only bu'ashim, worthless sour berries. That is a sad song. That's not so sad for you because you're not a farmer. But in that culture, that was a very sad event. And it's a dirge. It's a mourning song. Well, what does it mean? Well, let's find out the explanation of the parable as we begin to look at verse 3. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. Oh, now we know who he's talking about here. Me is the Lord, and my vineyard is the people of the Lord. This is a parable of God's relationship to his people. What more, verse 4, was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? What more could I have done? And what's the answer to the question? Nothing. You did everything you could do. Why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? Why did this happen? Was it my fault? Did I fail? Did I do something wrong? No, you put the choicest vine in the most fertile hill. You took all the stones out. You hedged it all around. You put in the tower of protection. You put the wine vat to produce the grape. You did everything you could possibly do. It wasn't your fault. The implication is it was just the fault of the vineyard, just the fault of the vine. Verse 5. So now let me tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge and it will be consumed. I'm going to take away its protection. I will break down its wall and it will become trampled ground. I will lay it waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, so briars and thorns will come up. And I will charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. That's called in the Old Testament a what? What did he do to the vine? He cursed it, right? In a sense. I pronounce judgment on that thing. I'm going to tear down its wall and let it be consumed. It's worthless. It's useless. Who wants bu'ushim? They're unedible. They're useless. So I'll lay it waste. Now what's he talking about here? Verse 7 tells you, the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of what? Of Israel. The men of Judah are his pleasant plant. And here's a little play on words. He looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. He looked for righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. And there's a double play on Hebrew words. In other words, God says, this is my nation Israel. Now think back through the parable. Go back to the beginning. Israel was planted as a vineyard, verse 1 says, in a fertile hill. Was the land of Canaan a fertile land? The Bible says it was the land of what? Milk and honey. The most fertile piece of ground in the world. The land of Israel. Absolutely strategically located at the intersection of two great continents, Europe and Asia. Three great continents, Europe and Asia and Africa. The vital spot in the world, and a very fertile place. He chose the best land. And then He not only chose the best land, but he planted it with the choicest vine. He chose the Jewish people, genetically a marvelous strain of humanity. The world is the beneficiary today of the Jews, who have led the world in many, many, many ways. They are a marvelous strain of humankind. And then it says that he dug it all around and removed its stones. When he put this noble vine, the Jews, in a choice place, Canaan, he removed all the stones. Remember what he told them to do? When you go in there, root out all the Canaanites. Get rid of all the enemies. And then he built a protection around them. He built a tower, probably a reference to Jerusalem. Jerusalem was the high place, the watchtower, the place where they were protected. And then it says, a wine vat, probably an allusion to the sacrificial system which God made for their sinful character as a provision. So God did everything He could do, and He expected them to produce good grapes. And what did Israel produce? Useless, worthless, sour berries. So God says, I'm going to judge you. I'm going to come in and I'm going to devastate you. And He was predicting the Babylonian captivity. And when it happened, they just swept in there, crushed the place, devastated it. And that was judgment. Now, why did God judge those people? Let's go to verse 8 and find out. There are six sins they committed that are identified specifically here. Six sins that brought about the judgment of God upon Judah. Number one is in verse 8. By the way, we'll get to that at the end of chapter 5. Let's just look first of all at the six sins. First sin is in verse 8. Now these were the specific factors in their move away from God. Okay, now follow these and see if these don't sound very familiar. Number 1, verse 8. Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until there is no more room. What is this? This is what I will call grasping materialism. This is a condemnation of people who are accumulating, amassing houses and lands, literally to the point that they have excluded people. They have consumed everything within their purview, everything within their range, everything within their reach. So that they stand alone in the midst of the land. And verse 9 says, many houses shall become desolate. They have accumulated many houses, much wealth. Even great and fine houses, verse 9 says, will be without occupants. I'm going to judge those. I'm going to empty those houses. They're going to become barren. And all that land you've gotten and all that rich farmland, verse 10, 10 acres of vineyard will yield only one bath of wine, and a homer of seed will yield but an ephah of grain. Those are famine conditions. In other words, the land will produce minimal, absolutely minimal. It wouldn't even be enough to live on. So he says, I'm going to judge you for your materialism, for the constant accumulation of things, houses and lands. You know what Israel did? Judah did? You remember how God instituted the Jubilee year? Remember how God instituted the Sabbath year? Every 7 years, you remember, there was a land rest. And every 50 years, there was another land rest, and the land went back to its original owner, and the land had that rejuvenation process every 7 years. They had violated that. They had failed to let the land rest every 7 years. And actually, God punished them for the abuse of the land, which was representative of their unbelievable materialism. Continual accumulation of things. And that's the first sin that caused God's judgment to fall. Does that sound familiar? As one person said, if God didn't spare them, how in the world can He spare America? Second sin is verse 11. Woe, and by the way, woe means damn, curse, consigned to judgment. It could read, damn those who rise early in the morning that they may pursue strong drink, who stay up late in the evening that wine may inflame them, and their banquets are accompanied by lyre and harp, by tambourine and flute, and by wine. But they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of His hands. I think that's the human body. They give no regard for their human body. These are the good time Charlies, you know. These are the party animals. These are the people who are committed, we'll call it drunken pleasure seeking. Drunken pleasure seeking. What's the first characteristic of an alcoholic? Anybody can tell you this. They drink when? In the morning. Here you have drunkenness. All day and late at night you have the banquet, you have the music, the tambourine, the flute, the wine, the dance, the whole shot. It's the typical barroom scene, the party scene. That too characterized the nation of Judah. They were guilty of the sin of grasping materialism, and they were guilty of the sin of drunken pleasure seeking. The third woe pronounced against them is down in verse 18. This curse comes upon them. And it says, woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood and sin as if with cart ropes, and who say, let him, speaking of God, make speed. Let him hasten his work that we may see it. And let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass that we may know it. Boy, this is an unbelievable picture here. The picture is this. It pictures a man or a woman like a jackass or a donkey or a mule or an ox who is hitched up with cart ropes to a huge wagon full of sin. That's the picture. And they're dragging around this mammoth big load of sin like a beast of burden. So he's talking here about living a grossly sinful life. The idea is that you've got so much sin in your life, you have to be hitched up to the wagon like a beast of burden just to haul it around. Then it says, and it is not just sinfulness, it is defiant sinfulness. Because it says, let him make speed. In other words, God, if you don't like it, do something about it. Show me yourself. If you don't like this, hasten your work. Let the purpose of the God of Israel draw near. In other words, it's mocking sinfulness. It's defiant sinfulness. It's shaking your fist in the face of God and saying, if you don't like it, God, you know what you can do about it. That's defiant sinfulness. I remember reading about Ernest Hemingway. There was an article in one of the national magazines that said Ernest Hemingway, if anyone, had proven that there was no God because he had defied biblical principles, he had defied Victorian morality, he had tumbled women all over the world, fought in revolutions, lived exactly the way he wanted to live, and enjoyed life to its fullest. 10 years from the day that that article was written, he put a gun to his head and blew his brains out. You can't defy God and get away with it. I remember when Sinclair Lewis, the great writer, wrote Elmer Gantry. Elmer Gantry was a strong slap at Christianity. It portrayed Elmer Gantry as an evangelist who was a womanizing drunk. I mean, it was a perfect picture of, say, a Jimmy Swaggart phenomena. Only it was used to mock and distort Christianity and make Christianity a laughingstock. And it was Sinclair Lewis's way of shaking his fist in the face of God. He was a brilliant playwright. Few people know that Sinclair Lewis died as a stumbling, bumbling, idiotic, slobbering drunk in a third-rate clinic outside the city of Rome. You do not shake your fist in the face of God. But we have people in our culture doing that, living as if there were no God at all, and in a sense, daring God to react. That's defiant sinfulness. It was true then, it's true today. Look at verse 20, for the fourth sin that characterized Judah. Verse 20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Let's call this perverted morality. Perverted morality. We've reversed everything. I mean, I remember when marriage was right. Marriage was right and premarital sex was wrong. Now marriage is looked down on and premarital sex is a way of life. I remember when homosexuality was a crime of massive proportions, not only legally but morally. Now homosexuality is a way of life and we have to give them equal rights. Morality has been totally flip-flopped. What used to be wrong is right, and what used to be right is wrong. It's wrong to be moral. It's wrong to hold a high standard of sexual conduct. That's wrong now. It used to be right. You all went through high school English or somewhere along the line and read Nathaniel Hawthorne, right? And you read about an adulteress who had an A stamped on her head. And she had to go all through her whole life with a big A on her head. Because society said, that is wrong. And we will make it apparent that it is wrong. And we will make the price so high that people won't want to do that. We'll put some restraint in society. Now, adultery is right and marriage is mocked. Perverted morality. It's the same thing today. Nothing new. Look at the fifth sin. Verse 21. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. This is arrogant conceit. They were conceited. They had all the answers. Wise in their own eyes, clever in their own sight. That's our society. We got everybody giving their opinion. You know, sometimes I think if I hear another talk show, I'm going to get sick and throw up. Somebody else's opinion. Who cares? Who cares? I'll tell you just a little personal thing. I think Phil Donahue, particularly Phil Donahue, has been the single most impactful person in America in the devastation of American morality. Why? Because he has given a forum to every deviated viewpoint. And he has therefore made it mainstream. Geraldo Rivera, Oprah Winfrey, whoever, has followed in that train of legitimizing deviations by giving them a platform of respectability and putting them in a dialoguing position where they can advocate their viewpoint. All this talk, all this arrogant conceit, everybody knows what's right, everybody's got all the answers, is nothing but a mass of pooled ignorance. Man is very conceited, very arrogant. Not only is he arrogant in terms of his relationship to the living God, but he's arrogant in terms of his relationship to other people. That's why it's so difficult for him to have a significant relationship, because he doesn't understand the meaning of humility. Last sin mentioned in verse 22, this is very interesting. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe. The heroes and the valiant men are leaders. Those are Hebrew terms for leaders. What you're having here is corrupt leaders who drink, who get drunk, and maybe drive their car into Chappaquiddick and drown somebody. You're talking about leaders who take a bribe, crooked judges, people who can be bought off, senators, mayors, congressmen, police, who are stealing the money that they're confiscating in drug busts. You're talking about corrupt leadership. And they even take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. These are the sins that corrupt a nation. Grasping materialism, drunken pleasure-seeking, defiant sinfulness, inverted or perverted morality, arrogant conceit, and corrupt leadership. And I submit to you, young people, that we've got them all. Would you agree? In big-time doses. The question is this, and this is what I want to talk to you for the next 15 minutes about. The question is this. This inevitably brings what? The judgment of God. It is an unequivocal fact. This brings the judgment of God. And verse 24 of chapter 5 says it. As a tongue of the fire consumes stubble and dry grass collapses into the flame, so their root will become like rot and their blossom blow away as dust, for they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. When a nation turns its back on the word of the living God, it will be judged. Mark it. It will be judged. God does not change His standard. And so, in verse 25 to the end of the chapter, that judgment is described. I'm not going to read that to you. God will judge. I believe God will judge this nation. If God doesn't judge America, He'll have to apologize to Israel, Judah, and Sodom and Gomorrah. God will judge this nation. Now, the question is this. You're here, I'm here. What kind of person does it take to reach a nation on the edge of judgment, right? That's the question. You're talking about missions. You're talking about being used by God. What kind of person does it take to touch this nation or any nation inevitably under the judgment of God? Let's find out in chapter 6. Let's find out. Verse 1. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord. What a statement. What a statement. Isaiah says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. You say, well, why does he mention the year of King Uzziah's death? Was that important? Well, it was if your name was Uzziah. But it was more than that. Let me tell you what happens. Uzziah had been king, listen to this, 52 years. Can you imagine having a president for 52 years? You get pretty used to him. Uzziah was a king 52 years. Very successful. Israel was strong economically. Israel was strong culturally. Israel was even strong religiously. The form of religion was still being cranked out. Israel had a very strong position in the Cold War. In other words, they were militarily strong, and so their enemies did not come against them. 52 years of peace, 52 years of prosperity, 52 years of religious well-being. Uzziah had really done a very, very good job. A good job. And you know what? No matter how far the nation drifted away from God, in the back of everybody's mind, they thought, well, but Uzziah is still king. And as long as Uzziah is king, that's sort of God saying, you're okay. It's like having a Christian president. You say, gee, God hasn't totally abandoned us. We still got a Christian president here. We've still got Uzziah, and certainly that's a symbol of God's blessing, so we must be okay. And so they were banking on the fact that Uzziah was still alive, and he was sort of the symbol of God's blessing. And you know what Uzziah did? He said to himself, you know, I'm something. He said, I've been 52 years doing this. And boy, look what I've accomplished. And as soon as he did that, God killed him dead. Just like that. He got diseased, out of the picture. Now what? Now all of a sudden, Isaiah says something's up. The symbol of God's protective blessing is dead. Executed by God. And where is Isaiah going to go? He goes right to the temple. Why? He's got to check in with God and find out what's going on. He goes to the temple, and he has a vision of the Lord. This is really incredible. I don't know what a vision is. Somewhere between reality and a dream. It's not a dream, and it's not a reality in the sense that we know it. It's not something that you can actually touch, take a picture of, or reproduce, but it's not just a thought. It's something divine between those two things, miraculously created by God, to express a divine revelation and reality. So here goes Isaiah, and he's checking in with God. God, what's going on here? You just killed the king of 52 years. Isaiah's smart enough to know the nation's in terrible drift spiritually. He also knows that Tiglath-Pileser is sitting up on the northern border, and now that Uzziah is out of the picture, there's imminent reality facing them, that the disaster of an invasion could occur. So he goes to God, and watch what happens. He says, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high or lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. This is really an amazing thing. He goes into the temple. God gives him this vision. He sees the Lord. What did he see? He saw the Lord. How would he have seen the Lord? The Lord is the Spirit. He saw probably the Shekinah glow, the glory of the Lord. He saw up high, lofty, majestic, sovereign, that's what all of that is saying, with a throne of his temple, or his emanating Shekinah trailing off behind him. Blazing image of God's spiritual presence sitting on a high, exalted throne and flowing down from that this emanating Shekinah glory of blazing light. and it just fills the whole temple that he's in. You say, what's the significance of this? The significance is Uzziah's dead, God's not. Right? Uzziah's off the throne, God's still on it. Whew. Right? I mean, everything's falling apart, God. I'm just glad to know. I'm checking in. I'm glad to know you're there. This is an affirmation that God is sovereign in what is happening. This is an affirmation that God is still in charge. And as he looks, in verse 2, seraphim, who are angels specifically given the task of guarding the holiness of God, apparently. Seraphim stood above him, and they each had six wings. Two to cover his face. Why? Because an angel is a created being, and no created being can look into the full glory of God and live. So even their vision of God has to be veiled by the wings that God gives them to veil it. With two, he covered his feet. Why? Because the very presence of God is holy what? Holy ground. And with two, he did, and the Hebrew word is hover, like a celestial helicopter. Would you please notice they have six wings? Four wings are associated with worship, and two wings are associated with service. Always the priority is worship. The two that covered the face related to worship. The two that covered the feet related to worship. Both affirming the glory and the holiness of God. Two by which they hover and can be dispatched to do God's bidding related to service. Worship is always the priority. Service always takes second place. And so he sees these incredible beings. And then in verse 3, one of those seraphim calls to another. And this is antiphonal, you know, back and forth. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory. And they're crying out about the holiness of God. This is what they are affirming. This is what they are celebrating. By the way, there's no other attribute of God given in Scripture that's repeated three times. It never says God is love, love, love. God is justice, justice, justice. Mercy, mercy, mercy. Grace, grace, grace. It never says anything other than holy, holy, holy. That is that which is most true about God. Holiness means His separateness. It means He is utterly unlike us because He is utterly without sin, without flaw, without error. He is utterly holy, utterly holy, utterly holy. And the trihagion, as it's called, refers to holy as the Father, holy as the Son, and holy as the Spirit. So it is a great, great statement about the holiness of God. The whole earth is full of His glory. So he sees sovereign, majestic, ruling, reigning God who is also perfectly holy. This is a frightening thing. Look at verse 4. The foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of Him who called out while the temple was filled with smoke. The whole building starts to shake. Whole building, why? Because when you're in the presence of a holy God, that is a traumatizing event. The place starts to fill with smoke. Do you remember when God came down to Mount Sinai? Mount Sinai was enveloped in what? In smoke. And our God is a consuming fire, says the Bible. So you're seeing a holy God, a holy consuming fire, who has a holy hatred of sin. And here is this humble prophet Isaiah. He's having a vision of God, and this vision is a frightening scene. You remember Manoah, the father of Samson, came home one day and said to his wife, "We'll die. I've seen the Lord." What do you mean you'll die? You've seen the Lord. Isn't God a real buddy-buddy? Isn't He a nice, warm, fuzzy grandfather type? You can jump up in His lap and have a little fellowship. Manoah says, "I saw God. I'll die." Why are you saying that, Manoah? Because if I saw God, God saw me. And if God saw me, He saw sin. And God destroys sin. That's it. You know all these goofy people who say they went to heaven and saw God? Don't believe it. That guy, Dr. Eby, who comes back all the time from heaven. He came back from heaven. The first time I heard him speak, he came back from heaven. He said, "I've just been to heaven, and if I want to renew the experience, I smell the tie I wore the day I went because it still has the heavenly smell on it." And he said, "When I went to heaven, I met God, and God took me around, and I'm happy to announce there are no bathrooms and there are no bedrooms in heaven," and everybody laughed. This was on Channel 40. And my response to that is, that man better be careful. That's blasphemous. My response was, "My dear friend, if you saw holy God, you'd be coming back and fearing for your very life." Because if you saw him, he saw you, and you knew he saw you, and you know what you're like. I had a preacher tell me one time, he was a charismatic preacher. He said, sometimes when I'm shaving, Jesus comes in the bathroom, puts his arm around me, and we talk. That's what he told me right at lunch. We were eating Mexican food, and I dropped my taco. He said to me, do you believe that? I said, no, I don't believe that. He said, you don't believe that? I said, no, I don't believe that. And what disturbs me equally is I believe you believe that. I said, you mean the real Jesus comes in while you're shaving and puts his arm around you and talks to you? He said, that's right. And I said, my only question is this, do you keep shaving? Because if the living Christ came in, you'd fall on your face in sheer terror. The disciples in the boat, remember the night they were in the boat and Jesus was sleeping? And the Bible says they were very afraid. And then Jesus stood up and stilled the storm. And it says they were exceedingly afraid. You see, what's worse than a storm outside your boat is God in your boat. So you're talking about holy God. You're not talking about some gray grandfather type. People in the Old Testament who had a vision of God were terrorized by it. Yesterday I was reading in some magazine about a lady who's been to heaven and back, and she's running around the country. You know, listen, if you went to heaven and saw God, you're not going to come back and say, I'm going on Christian TV and tell about my... No way. You'd be on your face. If Jesus came in and put his arm around you while you're shaving, you'd be groveling in the ground looking for an escape hatch. The presence of an infinitely holy God. Look at Isaiah's reaction. Verse 5. Then I said, wow, I'm going to go on Christian TV and tell everyone I saw God. Is that what he said? He didn't say that. He says, woe is me. Do you think he knows what that word means, woe? He just used it how many times in chapter 5? 6. It means damn me, curse me, assign me to hell, condemn me. I'm ruined. It's a Hebrew word, means I'm disintegrating, I'm going to pieces. I'm falling apart. Why? Because I'm a man with a dirty mouth. That's what unclean lips mean. I'm a man with a dirty mouth. You say, Isaiah, wait. Now look. If you're going to make it in the ministry, you've got to have a better self-image. You've got to really get a grip on the fact that you're a beautiful person. You'll never make it. Whoa, that's a bad. You've got to have some self-esteem. Isaiah says, look, I'm a man with a dirty mouth. You say, Isaiah, you got the best mouth in the country. You open your mouth, God talks. You're a prophet. Now, talk about a dirty mouth. There's always, you know, AB over. He's got a real dirty mouth. But you're. Why does he say that? I'll tell you why. Because the mouth is the primary indicator of your sinfulness. You don't as often sin with your ear, do you? Or with any other part of you as you do with your what? Mouth. And so all he's saying is, I'm a sinner. I'm a sinner. And I've just seen a holy God. I'm done. I'm out. This is the end of me. Goodbye. He'll consume me in a breath. So long, Isaiah. Not only that, I'm frightened to death for another reason. Not only do I have a dirty mouth, but I live among a people of dirty mouths. I've just seen a holy God. I'm one of a whole bunch of dirty mouth people that are about to get consumed. You say, well, now you can't think about yourself like that. The reason I do, he says in verse 5, is I've just seen the King. By comparison, I'm done. I'm finished. And there he is, traumatized, devastated, ruined, fearing for his life. Like Peter, you remember in Luke 5? He's out trying to fish. He never could catch fish after he was called to the ministry. The Lord rerouted all the fish. He never came anywhere near his net. He's out there trying to fish anyway, Luke 5. Can't catch anything. The Lord says from the shore, try the right side of the boat. Boy, that'd irritate me. Somebody said that like I didn't, you know, like how silly am I? The boat's in one spot. The fish know the right from the left. I haven't done that. What kind of a thing is that? But the Lord had a very authoritative voice. He put his net down, got so many fish they couldn't get him in. Remember that? What did Peter say? Wow, what a miracle. Whoa, I want to tell about this one. No, he said, depart from me, O Lord, for I am a what? sinful man, when he saw the fish move at the command of Jesus Christ, he knew he was in the presence of God, and all he could do was be afraid for his own life. He was afraid for his own life. See, when you have a vision of God, young people, it results not in pride, it results in a fear of a holy God's right to destroy you as a wicked sinner. It is a vision of the holiness of God that we see here. Watch what happens in verse 6. Does God snuff him? Let's see. One of the seraphim flew to me. Here comes one of these holy angels flying down with those two flying wings. And he's got a burning coal in his hand, which he had taken from the altar with tongs. And he touched my mouth with it. Woo! You say, that's step one, judgment. Yeah. Can you imagine having somebody take a hot coal off a barbecue and put it in your mouth? I mean, just whoosh, fry your lips instantly. And that coal would be there for a long time. Just embedded. I mean, that's a frightening kind of thing, physically. You say, oh, that's step one. The next coal is going to hit his eye, the next coal is going to hit his ear, and he's going to be gone. But look what happened. Isn't this something? The coal touched his mouth, symbolic of the sin that he acknowledged. And it says, your iniquity is what? Taken away, and your sin is what? Are we surprised by that? Isaiah says, I'm done. I'm ruined. Damn me. And what does God do instead of that? What does He do? He forgives him. He cleanses him. That's a picture of the grace of God in the cleansing of salvation. So there he is. And God has just done an unbelievably gracious thing to this dirty mouthed man. God has cleansed him. Forgiven him. And the symbol of that forgiveness is demonstrated. Then, this is absolutely unbelievable. Look at verse 8. Just unbelievable. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, not the angels anymore, here's the Lord speak, whom shall I send? And who will go for us? The Trinity's talking here. Go where? Go to this nation and warn them, right? Go preach the message to them. Who am I going to send? I got an apostate people. I got an impending judgment. I got one dirty mouth man amidst a whole dirty mouth people, all sinners. Who am I going to send to this group? Then said I, here am I, send me. You say, are you kidding? You think I want a dirty mouth guy? Isaiah says here, some people have preached this and they say, Isaiah stood with great courage and said, here am I, send me. Oh, come on. This guy was fighting for his existence. He didn't say it. I'm a graduate of the Master's College in Biblical Studies. I've been to the Master's Seminary and gotten a 4.0. I have a lot of experience. I've been ordained. Send me. That's not what God wants. Say, I'm creative, clever, innovative, motivated, bold, courageous, experienced. Here, I think Isaiah probably said something like this. I'm here. I could go. You know, certainly no more than that. Want to hear the response of the Lord? He didn't go. Verse 9, he said what? Verse 9, what did it say? And he said what? Go! Is that good? He said, what kind of people is God looking for to go to a nation in crisis? Clever people, innovative people, creative people? Motivated people, strong leadership type people, people who have never sinned, people with perfectly pure mouths. No. What's he looking for? I'll tell you what he's looking for. Cleansed people who've had a vision of God, who understand His glory, who understand His sovereignty, as Taylor said, who understand His holiness, who understand their own wretchedness, their own sinfulness, and who understand His great grace toward them and who are willing to be His servants. That's what He's looking for. Do you fit? Do you qualify? Just not great geniuses God uses, not many noble, not many mighty. He's chosen the base things of the world, Paul said to the Corinthians, to confound the mighty. He's not looking for great people. He's looking for cleansed people. Can you identify with that? He's looking for people who understand that they ought to be in hell. He's looking for people that understand that they have no right to be cleansed. He's looking for people who know they have dirty hearts and dirty mouths, but by the grace of Jesus Christ, they've been touched and purified and forgiven. And God says, I'll send you. You're just what I want. A forgiven sinner who understands I am sovereign, I am holy, and who wants to represent me. That's the kind of people He wants. That's the kind of people it takes to reach His society. Do you qualify? Are you a sinner? Are you a forgiven sinner? Have you seen the holiness of God? You understand your own wretchedness? Then you are a living illustration of what God wants to do in the life of the people He wants to reach. Right? So you're the perfect person to go. Not your cleverness. Not your erudition. It's what God has done in your life. Do you have a vision of Him? Do you understand who you really are? A wicked, vile sinner, unworthy of anything, but grace has been given to you, you're forgiven, you go. The final note. Look what He tells Isaiah when he goes. He says, go and tell this people. You tell them, you're my man. Tell them, keep on listening, but don't perceive. Keep on looking, but don't understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive, their ears dull, their eyes dim, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts and return and be healed. What? What was that again? Tell them what? You go tell them to listen but don't really listen, to see but don't really see, to hear but don't really understand. Tell them that their ears are going to be dull, their eyes are going to be dim, they'll never figure this stuff out, and then return and be healed. They'll never come back, they'll never be restored. You just go tell them that they're going to be judged. What's He saying? He's going, go and tell them and remember this, nobody's going to listen to you. Tell them but they won't hear, show them but they won't see, explain to them but they won't understand. Then what in the world are you telling me? Does that sound like an interesting commission? Can you imagine getting to the point where you're being launched to the mission field and having the people say to you, now, here's the message we want to give you. First of all, we want to tell you nobody's going to listen to anything you say. Go, my brother. Go. Don't expect anybody to listen to anything you say. Oh, that's terrific. That's terrific. He asked the question I would ask. Verse 11. Then I said, Lord, what? How long do I do that? How long do I do that? A week? 2 weeks, Lord, maybe? Just a couple weeks of that? Nobody's going to listen? No, He said, keep doing it until the cities are devastated and without inhabitant, the houses are without people, and the land is utterly desolate. Keep doing it until I've removed everybody far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. Just keep doing it until there's nobody left to do it to. You say, why am I doing this, Lord? Verse 13. Because in the middle of this, there will be a tenth portion in it. What does He mean by that? That's what we call the doctrine of the remnant. There'll be a little percentage there whom God has chosen from the foundation of the world. That's what He's saying. He calls it a stump in verse 13. The holy seed is the stump. Young people, you know what we're after? That's what we're after. We're going to go and we recognize, hey, I've been doing this for a long time. Most people aren't interested in what I say. But there is an elect seed. There is a stump at the root of this human tree that is the holy seed. And that's whom God has designed for us to reach. Right? There's promise. And you want to know something? Jesus said, I'll build my church and the gates of hell will not what? Prevail against it. You want to be the kind of person God wants you to be? To do what He wants you to do in this culture? Be like Isaiah. Father, thank You for our time.